of the committee. I'm sure you had a great weekend, and today begins the work again. Today is March 21st, 2005, Monday, and we will begin with our informational meeting concerning the Oregon's public ports. And we have invited testimony, and I know the Ken Armstrong and Pat Egan here. And if you'd like to come together, it's fine. And
Chair, we've got a couple of other folks we'd like to bring with us, if that's all right.
Yes, of course. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
And whoever wants to, yes.
Mr. Chair, my name is Ken Armstrong. I'm the director of the Oregon Ports Group, and we're here at your request, and I'm pleased to hear that the committee is interested in hearing from Oregon's public port districts. We come every session to give an overview to Transportation Committee, Economic Development Committee, and as I said, we're very pleased to be here. I'm going to keep my part of this extremely short, as we've got I've got with me some gentlemen who can give some good, specific details about the ports. I've got a representative of a coastal port, Mr. Don Mann from Newport, from the Columbia River Gorge, Mr. Dave Harlan from Port of Hood River, and then also Pat Egan from the Port of Portland to talk about the stretch of the Columbia River system, both upriver and lower river, and how the freight system works, etc. Briefly, Oregon's ports, there are 23 of them, public ports in the state of Oregon, all run by elected commissions with the exception of two, Port of Portland, Oregon International Port of Coos Bay. Their boards are comprised of gubernatorial appointees. The rest are elected locally. Ports are municipal corporations, have the ability to tax, to issue bonds, to own and sell property. Our primary mission, the primary mission of Oregon Ports, is economic development. So everything that we do that is tasked to us in ORS Chapter 777 and 778, excuse me, is to promote economic development and job creation around the state. With that, I want to turn to my colleagues that can give you more specific details about their regions of the state. I think perhaps I'll start with Mr. Mann here to my left, and I'll step to the side and bring Mr. Harlan over, and of course we're happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ken. Mr. Chairman, I want to yield to my colleague to the left from Port of Portland. We'll go left to right.
Okay. I have no one to turn to, so
I'll go that way.
Actually, I'm going to just beg off for just a second. Don, you go ahead. I'm going to go clear my... I'm losing my voice. I got a cold.
Right, Chairman Lim, other members of the committee, my name is Don Mann. I'm the general manager of the Port of Newport on the Oregon coast, and I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today and talk a little bit about my port and also in general coastal ports and the important role they play in the communities. But what I'd like to do is first start, I'm going to read the mission for the Port of Newport, and if you'd keep that in mind, most every port on the coast follows this type of mission, and as Mr. Armstrong did point out, economic development is a key. The mission for the Port of Newport is to promote and support projects and programs in cooperation with other community organizations and businesses that will create new jobs and increase community economic development. This is a cry up and down the coast, both for industrial business, commercial business, and tourism on the coast, which is very important. And what's tied into this and keeps it all together are the ports. And the coastal ports struggle each year with the federal government in dredging costs. It's no different on the Columbia River. Every port, every small port on the coast relies on safe entrances to their harbors and ports. And, of course, Newport is no exception. To give an example, we're a deep draft port. There's two on the coast, Coos Bay and Newport, and then you go up to the Columbia River. And both of the ports on the coast that are deep draft, our history is for moving wood products, lumber products, and some bulk cargoes. The mission of the port to continue to preserve economic development. When each year when the budget comes out from the federal government for dredging, the example I'd like to set is we've been in pretty good shape as a deep draft port because of our deep draft status. However, next year's budget, 2006, our budget's been cut in half. And other small ports on the coast for the last 5 to 10 years have been either reduced or completely cut out of the budget for dredging. This is critical to the ports to maintain dredging on the port. We've had a lot of good work and cooperation with the state of Oregon through the Economic Development Department in creating different funds of assistance. Marine Navigation Improvement Fund is one for assisting local sponsors in working on new navigation projects, and we're very grateful to that. So we maintain deep water ocean access. That's one of our keys, and also the shallow draft ports do the same. We have to maintain that water depth in order for two things. One is for commerce, tourism, and most important is safety. We also maintain an adequate inventory of developable lands, working with new businesses and trying to recruit businesses. It doesn't matter if it's a large business or small business. Each port on the coast has this obligation to their community to assist in bringing in new jobs. All the ports on the coast, especially in recreation and tourism, are very competitive, and this is an ongoing process with the ports. And the policy and regulatory climate that we have to deal with all the time with the Corps of Engineers, the Coast Guard, and local government is an ongoing process. And we also work hard with ODF&W in maintaining fishery stocks and our natural resources. So basically, to sum it up, I'm not going to take a whole lot of time. Tourism is a mainstay on the coast for small ports. Commercial fishing is very important to ports like Newport, which were one of the largest commercial ports on the coast. We rank 17th in the nation in poundage and landings, and 26th in the nation in total value brought into the community. So it's very important that we maintain the viability of ports on the coast, and the it doesn't matter if it's Brookings or Port of Tillamook Bay, Garibaldi. We all work together to continue to maintain economic development on the coast. So with that, if there's any questions at the end, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any questions? Representative Dallin.
Yes, you were talking about dredging and that the federal government's been cut in half, and then you mentioned the state. What is the state's part in dredging, or is there any?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dallin, the state's role in maintenance dredging, they do not play a role. The maintenance dredging on the coast has always been the mission of the Army Corps of Engineers, and through federal cuts, ongoing federal cuts, changes in government process and regulations, the Office of Management Budget and the administration, it gets tougher and tougher each year, and they've began to look at dredging based on how much commerce you move, high output ports commercial-wise, and low output ports, and the recreational ports do not seem to fall into that category, or the smaller, lower output ports. So the state's role, when I mentioned the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund, are for support of local projects that the, say, the Port of Newport. If we had a small project within the harbor connecting to another channel, or a federal existing channel, we can go to the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund for assistance in our share for that federal project. So it's important that we continue to maintain that relationship with the Economic Development Department, especially with that particular fund, because there are new projects all the time. But as far as maintenance, the state is not involved in providing funds for maintenance for the harbors and channels.
Thank you.
Okay. There you go. All right. Okay. I think I've got it back. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to come and speak with you this morning. I've got a PowerPoint presentation, which I'm not going to walk through page by page, but just as background for you, to give a little bit of a snapshot on some of our economic impacts, some of our assets, and what we see as some of the challenges going forward. Port Portland is really a transportation hub for the entire state. That's how we view ourselves in many ways. We have a statewide transportation mission and work closely with not just the other ports and other airports, but individual private shippers and companies in developing their business. I think Ken said it well and speaks for us as well in saying that we've got an economic development mission as one of our primary goals. So this is a perfect committee for us to spend a little time in front of and talk about our mission. Quick overview I'm going to give you is a little bit about our assets, a little bit about our challenges, what we have given you in terms of economic data on what we do for the region, and then to talk about some of our challenges going forward. We're a consolidated port, which for me, when I came to the Port of Portland, sounded like a no-brainer. By consolidated port, I mean we've got both marine and aviation functions under one umbrella organization. But as it occurs, that's actually a fairly unique thing nationwide. We're one of only 12 ports of our size that has both marine and aviation. And that allows us to look at transportation sort of across the board, regardless of the shipper, regardless of the passenger. We look at all transportation services and view things through that lens. We have four airports, four marine ports, seven industrial parks, and as I mentioned, we work extensively with a lot of private businesses, including rail, which I know this committee has a keen interest in as well. We are, as I call it, an indicator species of the economy. If the economy is not doing well in the state of Oregon, our total businesses are down. If the economy is doing better, our total businesses are up. One point on this, I'll fast forward to aviation, which I'm going to put at the end of my discussion, but post-September 11th, our aviation business went down dramatically, and that was a result of a variety of things, but we're back now up above September 11th levels. We had over 13 million passengers in calendar year 2004. See, that is a very good thing. On the marine side, we have had, in some ways, the best of years and the worst of years. The worst of the year is what you heard about, the loss of container service, and we are working literally every day on reestablishing that for our customers and for the region, and we're hoping to have some good news on that sometime in the near future. Overall, despite what you heard, we actually had a record year on the marine side, record total volume and tonnage across the board. We have autos, mineral bulks, grain bulks, and the containers. We are the number one auto port on the West Coast. We're the number one grain port in the United States, and the number one mineral bulk port on the West Coast. So we're number three in total volume on the West Coast. It's the containers that get the most coverage, and that's for good reason. They're high value goods that go through the containers. They're very key.
Could you, before you go on, where's the number one? Where's the number two in the port?
Senator Lynn?
You also mentioned that our port is in business wise number three. And who is the number one and number two?
In total volume?
Total volume.
I'm not sure, and that's total tonnage. So I believe Port of Tacoma would be number two, and I believe Port of Long Beach would be number one. Los Angeles is a much larger port in terms of total containers, but they don't bring in the other bulks that we bring in. So that's across all business lines, bulks, autos, and containers. So,
okay.
The auto business is one that I like to tell a little bit of a story about because it indicates that our logistics are very good. Autos need to get to wherever they need to get to very rapidly, whether it's Chicago, Texas, any place across the United States, and including Portland. The reason we are number one on the auto business, we believe, is because once you get on the docks at Portland, we can get to virtually any place in the United States faster than most of the other ports, particularly with the congestion that we've been seeing over the last couple of years. So our rail connectivity is very good. We've got direct service with Union Pacific and Burlington Northern, and our highway access is very good. We work closely with a number of trucking firms, and I-84 and I-5 are key assets for us as well. One thing before I move off of marine is I get asked all the time, how's channel deepening going? The good answer is it's going very well. We had a good year last year with the federal government giving $9 million to the project through the Army Corps of Engineers. The state of Oregon, after you all had taken action last session, sold its bonds last August and put $27 million toward the project. And Washington State has allocated $27 million to the project. So this year, calendar year 2005, we will, we believe, be doing 25 of the 106 miles of the channel. And only 56 of the 106 miles actually need to have any dredging whatsoever. So we consider this to be a very key year that will allow ships to come in heavier, which is a very key thing for containers, for container service, and for wheat bulks and other grain bulks. Just quickly on the aviation side, as I mentioned, we have four airports, Portland International, Hillsborough, Troutdale, and Molino. Portland International, obviously, is the biggest piece of that. I mentioned 13 million plus passengers last year, 34 carriers, and three of the key ones I've highlighted there are links internationally. Lufthansa to Frankfurt, Northwest Airlines to Tokyo, and Mexicana to Guadalajara. We're the smallest airport in the United States that has both direct service to Europe and to Asia, and it's a key economic driver for the region, we believe. On to the challenges, as I mentioned, containers. On the marine side, that's our number one challenge. We're focused on it virtually every day. Our port director, Bill Wyatt, I can barely keep track of him. His mileage must be incredible. He was in China a couple of weeks ago and is having extensive discussions with a number of container service companies and is getting a lot of interest, in part because of the congestion that you may have heard about over last summer and fall, both in L.A. Long Beach and up in the Puget Sound. They experienced quite a bit of congestion as well. You hear a lot about the larger and larger container vessels, and that some of those vessels will not be able to come up to Portland. That is in fact true, but actually the majority of the new ships being built today, we will be able to take in a 43-foot channel, and we consider those to be the workhorses of the Trans-Pacific and a key to our future. On the aviation side, I mentioned the International Air Service. That's our key challenge there, is to maintain that International Air Service, make sure those planes are full, and make sure that the companies have no reason to question their decision to come to Portland. And so far, they've been very happy, and we're pleased with that. I also mentioned rail. We have 47 miles of trackage on our property total. We care a great deal about rail connectivity, whether it's a short line down in southern Oregon or the two main stems that I mentioned earlier. We're working closely with a number of rail services going forward. And then road, highway, both trucks and passengers care a lot about that and are keenly interested in the transportation funding picture in the state of Oregon. Last thing I'll mention is to put in a mention of Connect Oregon, which you've probably heard a little bit about. That's the multimodal package. There are a number of bills out there now. The primary one that's been discussed in Senate Transportation is Senate Bill 71. We're very encouraged at the progress going forward. Last thing I'll say about that is we see that as a key competitive element for the state of Oregon going forward. Washington State in 2003 put almost $300 million in grants through their legislature into the rail system in Washington State. Over the last 10 years, California has invested over nearly $1 billion in rail. In the form of grants, and they've also put a great deal into their marine system. So we are hopeful and confident that will be a positive thing going forward, not just for the Port of Portland, but for the entire state. Thank you very much. And I'll take any questions.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of quick things. You probably know I'm from Hillsborough.
Absolutely.
And so I wanted to talk a little bit about Hillsborough Airport and see what are the most immediate plans and what do you see for Hillsborough?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, the immediate plans are to deal with the increasing volume that I'm sure you've heard from folks about. As it happens, Intel is actually the second largest airline in the state. And when I say that, people say, what are you talking about? And the reality is they move an incredible number of people through that facility on a daily basis to their other facilities around the United States, particularly on the West Coast. We are talking regularly with the city of Hillsborough and with Washington County about potential expansion, realignment of the road leading in, and hopefully get a terminal improvement at some point in the near future as well. I would be happy to sit with you and go over our master plan for that facility and talk with you about some of the public outreach we've done as well. But in the near term, it's to try and make sure that we've got the necessary infrastructure, including a terminal improvement and including the road access that we think we're going to need going forward.
Thank you. And I would like if you, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I would like if you would make an appointment and
absolutely.
Sit down and chat with me about
you bet. That. Absolutely.
Thank
yeah.
you very much.
Thank you.
Concerning the when you're talking about the port, it seems to me we are not doing the best compared to the other states like Tacoma, Los Angeles, and the Long Beach area. We are losing continually container ships, and plus the compatibility, such as the Columbia River coming over here, they're losing almost 15, more than 15 hours round trip. And then we need to continue to dredging up the Columbia Channel. This is a real challenge. And do you think in the future we shall be able to capture some of the containers and the plus of the big ships? You mentioned that nowadays they are trying to make smaller ships than used to be, but still they are building larger ships.
They are.
And they are not able to come through this Columbia Channel. My final question, do you have any plan? And such as that Coos Bay area is one of the deepest the seaport we have, even Astoria. But why couldn't we develop some other ports might be more feasible economically, profitable for our state?
Mr. Chair, in answer to the first part of your question, we're doing everything we can to address the challenges that we've got today, including the labor, the investments necessary to maintain the infrastructure that we've got, and dealing with pilotage costs. The one story that I'll tell in answer to this is that the company that has stayed, Hanjin, which is a Korean company, has maintained their service, and their primary client is actually Fred Meyer Kroger. Kroger is now based in Cincinnati, but they own Fred Meyer. They were able to get their products through to the rest of the United States with virtually no delay last year, and they're very happy with that because, as we know, it's a just-in-time world. The more you can reduce your warehousing and keep that good flowing directly from where it's manufactured to where it's sold, which is what we facilitate, the better off you are. And Hanjin is actually out there talking with other container service companies to help us and to help other container service companies understand the value that Portland brings. The answer to the second part of your question about Astoria and Coos Bay is Bill Wyatt has said regularly, we're for whatever works. The challenge that you would have is just as we actually have existing today an international container facility, you would have to replicate not only the container facility, but the market surrounding it. Portland actually has a market relatively small compared to the other West Coast ports, but once you bring the good there, it's a local dray, and you've only got so far to bring it to the Fred Meyer, to the Nike warehouse, or wherever. In order to that doesn't exist today in Astoria or in Coos Bay. The last piece of that is the transportation connectivity in Astoria and Coos Bay. I mentioned we have direct service with Burlington Northern and Union Pacific. To replicate that, no one has done a study to look at what it would cost to build the necessary highway or rail infrastructure to connect to one of those other ports, but suffice to say, it would be several hundred million and probably several billion dollars to replicate that infrastructure. We have it today, and the channel project total will be about $150 million. Once that investment's made, many of the challenges that you mentioned are actually handled, dealt with.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I might also add just a bit to that. Again, Ken Armstrong. What we've seen in the state of Oregon, I think, is each of the ports has developed as it has for a reason. And that is not the least reason of which is sometimes the geographic or other constraints that are placed upon it. One of the constraints that Coos Bay has is that most of the docks down there in Coos Bay are privately owned. The port has a good amount of industrial property and has the ability to develop that, but the facilities that are down there are largely privately owned, and the cost then, as Mr. Egan has mentioned, of replicating that in Coos Bay is high. which is not to say that the Port of Coos Bay, I think if they were sitting here, would say that they're doing everything that they can to take a look at all of the options and the possibilities of putting themselves ahead down the road. Same situation with Astoria. They do the same, and the Oregon Ports Group exists to serve all the ports that are part of the membership. And it's interesting. We had a discussion in the Senate Transportation Committee when the specific question was, how is the Port of Portland helping the other ports? How do the other ports help one another? And I think there was, not to reiterate that entire testimony, but I think the committee saw that there was a tremendous amount of cooperation between all the ports, and I would certainly kick it to my colleagues at Port of Newport and Port of Hood River if they want to add anything to it. But I think you see that there's an awful lot of cooperation at trying to see to it that whatever the opportunities are, everybody tries to lend a hand and help make economic development and job creation happen.
Right.
Thank you. Representative Dallin?
Yes, I'd like to look the other direction, coming House District 59, other side of the mountain. And I'm looking at exports more than imports. Are we a major player when it comes to exporting forest products? And ag products?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vellum, we have been historically less so today than we were before. That is actually one thing that the coastal ports are able to do a little bit of. But as you are, I'm sure, aware, federal forest policy and even to some extent state forest policy has limited some of the activity there, so it's much less so than it used to be. The export question, I guess I would add to that, we're the only port on the West Coast, major port on the West Coast, that has more exports than it has imports, which historically has been a real advantage. That has meant that container service companies and other bulk service companies wanted to come to the Port of Portland, less so today than in the past, because there are so many imports coming in from Asia that they've got to find a place to come in, and it's actually cheaper and sometimes to get an empty container and move it back to Asia than to have a full container of whatever it would be, grains or other commodities, and find its way transporting wherever it needs to go in Asia. And I don't know whether, Ken, if you have anything to add on the coastal ports on the forestry question.
I'd probably let Don handle that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dallum, as I mentioned earlier, you know, and as Mr. Armstrong mentioned, geographically we're restrained on a lot of our activities. To give an example, up to about 5 years ago, we were exporting logs to China and Japan, and government restrictions decreased the commodity that we were shipping out. Actually, we started bringing in logs, coastwise cargo, from Alaska and the Olympic Peninsula to feed our smaller mills in close proximity to the Port of Newport, Corvallis, and Philomath. So the exports have decreased tremendously. Imports picked up a little bit. Most of our commodity is commercial fish at this point, but without the Port of Portland, for the local processors to ship containers to the port and out their facilities, we would be probably sending our commodities to Seattle. So the Port of Portland plays an important role to our industry. As I mentioned, we're ranked very high in the nation for total poundage and value, and our total values in fisheries in Newport reach 70 to 90 million a year in total value. So it's very important, but the agricultural industry has declined quite a bit over the last 5 years for coastal exports.
Is there anything that we in the legislature can do to increase or to make more efficient, quicker, faster, smarter imports, either with eliminating regulation or adding legislation? Is there anything we can do to stimulate the export of Oregon's raw materials and products?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dallum, at this point it seems to be that this is a very market-driven commodity at this point, and values and demand in Asia and the Pacific Rim. And at this point, without a large demand, the smaller, lower output commercial ports like Newport, like Coos Bay, are going to continue to suffer the export of wood products, materials, until that market either changes or there's more demand for the export commodity. At this point, there's really no more we can do.
For the Port of Portland, is there anything we can do here to help with farm products, fruit, fiber, wheat, and that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gollum, I'm going to jump back to your first question. Just overall, as I mentioned, anything that helps in economic development would help us, we believe. We look at the available supply of industrial land, for example. That's a key issue for us. Transportation infrastructure and investments really was, I would say, the biggest single issue that faces the legislature that we hope to see some improvement on. Even with the investments over the last couple of sessions, Oregon is still the lowest funded per mile and per capita state on the West Coast, among all Western states, actually still one of the lowest nationally. And these investments in other modes of transportation are very key for us. We have it continually haunts us that, for example, the Port of Seattle on an annual basis gets $59 million in property tax, and good for them. We get $7 million at the Port of Portland in property tax, so their infrastructure investments are more often paid for by their local constituents. In our case, about 3% of our total budget is property tax, and the remainder of that comes out of the customers, comes out of the shipping companies, comes out of our partners, and sometimes in the form of grants from federal and state agencies. The question on the agriculture side, we work closely with the Department of Agriculture. I just met with the Board of Agriculture last week to talk with them about Connect Oregon and infrastructure investments. We have marketing folks that work closely with not just the Department of Agriculture, but upriver producers, whether it's potatoes, grains, those kinds of things, and we work with them on trade missions to market Oregon products overseas as well. But really, the bottom line, the thing we're most focused on is infrastructure. Structure and making sure that we can move things as rapidly from one mode to the next.
Good morning, Chairman Lim, committee members. I'm Dave Harlan. I'm the Executive Director of the Port of Hood River. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. The Port of Hood River operates a public marina, a boat ramp, and a cruise ship dock. But like our sister ports to the east and west, the Port of Cascade Locks, the Port of the Dalles, we are not primarily involved in the handling of cargo. That doesn't mean that we don't have a sizable impact on the communities that we serve, but we're not actively shipping cargo, as per the typical definition of what a port does and is. There is considerable cargo moving on the river. The Port of Morrow and the Port of Umatilla are cargo ports. But the Port of Hood River, like the majority of Oregon's ports, is primarily and actively engaged in property development, constructing new buildings, developing new industrial and commercial lands. And as my colleagues have stated, we do that with the goal and the intent of trying to improve and diversify the economies that we serve. My port, in addition to owning and operating industrial buildings and developing industrial lands, also operates a marina, cruise ship, dock, a public boat ramp, along with an interstate toll bridge, an airport, waterfront recreational facilities, a public park, and a struggling exposition center. Many of the projects pursued by Oregon ports have resulted in critical successes for the communities they serve. Others have struggled initially, but have proved to be key catalysts over the passage of time. I'm going to talk about a couple of those projects. One project comes to mind involved the redevelopment of a blighted industrial area and deteriorated industrial buildings. Like a lot of economic development projects, it required considerable public investment up front, but that public investment has resulted in millions of dollars of private investment and hundreds of jobs. To do this project, an urban renewal district was established, and using tax increment financing, streets and sidewalks were renovated, utility lines were placed underground, lighting, benches, landscaping, and other public improvements were put in place. those streets, sidewalks, and other public improvements are scattered throughout downtown Hood River and have helped make our community the attractive and beautiful place it is today. The project was the Diamond Cannery redevelopment project, which the port took on in the mid-1980s. The Urban Renewal District is still functioning. The city and the port worked together to establish that district, and a port commissioner and a city councilor serve on that district board. When the port took on that project, it took on the redevelopment of roughly 12 square blocks of aging industrial property and 800,000 square feet of deteriorated industrial space. To accomplish the project, the port took on $11 million in debt. That debt was finally paid off in 2002. Some structures were demolished to make way for new buildings and development. The remainder renovated, and only one of those buildings remains in port hands today. All the others have been sold to private parties who are have redeveloped their own projects. Businesses now located in those buildings currently employ nearly 900 people. Companies such as Dakine Hawaii, Full Sail Brewing, Turtle Island Foods, Sprint, Humanity Software, Advanced Navigation and Positioning Corp., and Gorgonet are in those buildings. The last one we own, the Big 7 building, also houses a Columbia Gorge Community College Technology Center, which provides training for area employers. The port secured federal funds to equip the center. The port worked with the local electric co-op to have fiber optics extended to the building, and the port, in partnership with the college, helped pay for the improvements. So apparently we're also in the education business as well. The Diamond Project was not popular at the time. There were people who questioned it, challenged it, but if the port hadn't stepped up and you have to wonder what would have happened to those dilapidated buildings. And I think it's reasonable to conclude that downtown Hood River would look considerably different than it does today. Now let me contrast that success story with another one, one that took a lot longer to come to fruition, but in my opinion has been and will be just as pivotal for another mid-Columbia community. In the mid-1980s, same time frame as the Diamond Project, the Port of the Dalles, voters there approved general obligation bonds in a down economy that allowed the port to move ahead with developing shovel-ready industrial sites. The site was constructed, and in keeping with a U.S. Department of Commerce study from the mid-1990s, not much happened for a while, and the guy who built it got fired. I'm not sure that last point was actually in the study, but that has been my observation. The study concluded that your typical rural industrial park takes about 18 years to fill up. And that's essentially how things played out in the Dalles. Through hard work, perseverance, good decision-making, and good fortune, the absorption rate on that property picked up dramatically in the 1990s, mirroring the results of the Commerce Department report. Private parties began putting up small, speculative industrial buildings and filling them, and the port moved forward with preparing additional shovel-ready land. With the $1.47 million Chenoweth Creek Industrial Subdivision Project in late 1998. There were $720,511 of grant and loan money from the Oregon Economic and Development Department, Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, that went into that project. And I'm pretty familiar with it. I was OECDD's Regional Development Officer at the time and was involved with that project. As I'm sure you're aware, Google announced plans to develop significant facilities at the Port of the Dalles last month with purchase options for the remainder of the port's property. And that is potentially one of the great rural development success stories this state has seen. And the credit goes to the port staff and the commission and everybody else who did all the hard work and heavy lifting over the course of 20 years. Both the Diamond Project and the industrial development at the Port of the Dalles are examples of the kinds of diverse projects that Oregon ports have and are accomplishing in rural Oregon. But the Port of the Dalles success potentially brings it face to face with the problem we've been wrestling with in Hood River, a lack of marketable, competitive, shovel-ready, and available industrial property. One of the recent successes Hood River has enjoyed was the 2003 construction of the Cardinal Glass Industries plant in Odell on a former timber mill site just south of Hood River, and that's thanks to the mill site legislation that was approved by the last legislature. Cardinal recently finished a 146,000 square foot expansion to their original 196,000 square foot plant, boosting employment there to over 200. But beyond a few small lots at our nearby John Weber Industrial Park, there is no shovel-ready land available in my port district. The port has also developed and owns a 5.68-acre site in Hood River, which was the last large, put that in quotes, contiguous site available. We're completing a build-to-suit for Humanities Software there, and we have offers in hand for the remainder of the property, which leaves us right back to where we were a few years ago with just a few small lots at our other industrial property. Prior to the mill site bill, Hood River, my port district, didn't have the capacity to site new firms of even modest size in the immediate Hood River area, and we hadn't had it for some time. Because of that limited supply of industrial land, the property that we have acquired inside the urban growth boundary is substantially more costly than properties available in other communities. We have a 5.68-acre site inside the city is selling for $5.50 per square foot, and that's Wilsonville prices. It just shows the pent-up demand that has been there in the local economy. What that has meant is that local firms who have outgrown their facilities have had to look elsewhere. If you're the local beer distributor in Hood River, it's close to impossible to find an affordable site that's going to work for your business model. Because of that land cost differential, between our community and surrounding communities, businesses have had to look outside our community or pay double or triple and the price they would pay in nearby communities, for example, the Dalles. The Dalles has, in fact, been a beneficiary of the lack of developable land in Hood River. A couple of examples come to mind: Round Top Windows and Home Shield, Inc., which is currently at the Port of Hood River, but is going to expand in the Dalles because we just don't have the room to accommodate them. Now, that's a good thing in that we've managed to keep them in the region and we've managed to keep them in the state. But Hood River needs to find a way to accommodate expanding firms in the interest of its own long-term economic stability. In summary, sorry to be long-winded, Oregon's public ports, such as Hood River and the Dalles, have and continue to pursue economic diversification and development for the communities they serve, and we've had considerable successes. We're not like most other government agencies. We tend to fund ourselves from operational revenues, and we tend to go light on taxes. The Port of Hood River's tax base is less than $40,000. Among other things, public ports develop property and buildings, sometimes where no private market has yet emerged, and in the process, we take on risk and debt. Previous state and federal assistance has helped Oregon's public ports manage that debt and risk, and has resulted in very significant public benefits and returns to the Oregon economy. I believe finding ways to help Oregon's ports to continue to build on their successes and one of those challenges, we all face the lack of developable land, but helping Oregon ports do what we do best, in my opinion, is in the interest of the state and can and has made a difference in the lives of Oregonians. Thank you. If you have any questions, be glad to respond.
Representative Dedlam?
Yes, I think that we surely, at least in the Dalles, and we'll get out of the port business and go to Madras, and get out of the port business and go to John Day, and get out of the port business and go to Kimberley.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to make you king for a day. What are you going to tell me to do so that there is land available? If another Google or another round top window came to the Dalles right now, we'd have to put them in the basement of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do in this legislature to make Oregon agile, competitive, and available?
Well,
in rural areas.
Let me take a shot at this. I know there are currently some changes that are being looked at to the administrative rules on Goal 9, statewide planning goal for economic development. And these are just my opinions. In Hood River's case, I think about the mid-1990s and maybe to about 96 or 97, the city went through a comp plan review process and reached the conclusion that the 10 acres of land was an adequate 20-year supply of industrial property. Now, my predecessor at the port did not agree and made that clear in that process. But the port was viewed essentially like a private landowner would be viewed, as opposed to a public agency with a public mission. And the planning community clearly has a job to do as well, but at least in my opinion, they have not well understood the needs of industry and the needs of business. You could look at the absorption rate over the last 10 years in Hood River County and easily reach the conclusion that 10 acres wasn't an adequate supply for 2 years of needed development. So, I'm only speaking for myself here, but I think close attention to Goal 9, and making it something that communities have to address, as opposed to, I've had people refer to it as sort of an optional goal. I think ports and stakeholders need to be part of advisory committees guiding the processes that local planners go through to create these lands. And at least in my experience, we've typically been a voice from the outside trying to get to the table and have not been heard very often.
Maybe I better. I'll just add a couple of quick things on that, and I very much appreciate the question because I think that's one of the things that we wrestle with every single legislative session. Again, Ken Armstrong. Goal 9, as Mr. Harlan described, is definitely one of the biggest issues for us. It was one of the things, as we talked about our legislative agenda coming into this session, is that something we wanted to deal with? Given the fallout of ballot measure 37 and no one really knowing precisely how that's all going to fit together, we chose to sit tight and just kind of see how things unfold. But clearly, if you talk to other ports around the state, you'd find a very similar answer. Not all ports, but many of them would say the same thing. We do not have an adequate supply of buildable land. We do not have the ability to extend urban services outside of an urban growth boundary, for example. We do not have and I'm stepping beyond Goal 9, and beyond land use issues, we do not have all of the freight transportation infrastructure that we need to be able to attract the kind of businesses that will employ our people and take advantage of whatever land supply we have. So we get back again to Connect Oregon. We'll get back again to the funding programs that are within the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, Special Public Works, Marine Navigation Improvement Fund, Oregon Port Revolving Fund, Water, Wastewater, Regional Rural. There are myriad programs out there that ports, as well as our partners, the League of Oregon Cities, Counties, Special Districts Association, that we all utilize, that if this legislature is not able to, and I'm certainly not accusing it of failing to do this, but if this legislature doesn't take a real serious look at the tools that are available to it, as well as making some tweaks to some of the others that could better be availed, it's going to be much harder for those of us that are tasked with economic development and job creation to do our job, especially when we're in a down economy time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Pat. I think I called you last time, Ken, but
okay.
Haven't before that. Anyway,
not true.
And how much do we have in the port revolving funds? Yeah. How do we use that?
Mr. Chair, are you referring to the state port revolving fund?
Yes.
Of course. Ken might be better actually.
I think you did want Ken on that one.
Yeah.
Ken Armstrong. It's interesting. I just had a conversation with Mike Burton about this. He's not by any chance in the room, is he? We have total, I hope I'm not getting this wrong, and I will follow up with you on this, okay. Mr. Chair, to make sure I get the right information. Okay. But my impression is that we've got probably a total of $12 or $13 million circulating out there in dollars that have been borrowed by the ports and are in the process of being repaid. I think dollars that are actually available right now to make loans to a port district that applies to the revolving fund is something shy of $1 million.
Almost two.
Oh, it's almost two.
Almost two.
That's available right now?
Right.
Okay, I misspoke. But that gives you a sense of the magnitude.
Okay. Thank you. And if you give us some additional information, I will appreciate it.
Yes, I will.
As I read the material, the Port of Portland sold some lands. And who can give us some information? What one side talking about we don't have enough land, the Port of Portland sold some lands. And could you expound a little bit on the issue?
Mr. Chair, when you're referring to sold some land, I'm not...
Yes, I read some information here given to me that the Port of Portland sold some lands in the Port of Portland area. Are you not familiar with it?
We have a great deal of property today. We're in the process of acquiring some more. We recently sold one of our original terminals, Terminal 1, to the city of Portland. It was no longer functional. Had some other issues. They were willing to help us deal with some of those issues. Turned it over to them. Fairly small parcel, and actually hadn't been in marine operation for a number of years. We're also in the process today of working with Freightliner, which is actually one of our tenants and a major employer in the Portland region. They've been a tenant of ours for, I think, as long as they've been in business, for several decades, and they would like to acquire some of their property, and we're in the process of working with them, OECDD, and a few others, and putting together a package for them so that they can maintain the presence, actually expand their presence, which is what they're proposing to do. But beyond that, I don't have a specific answer, I guess. If there's a particular parcel, I'd be happy to talk with you about it.
Okay, thank you. I have one of the final questions concerning the main proposal in Regent's Port there to create jobs and economic development. And could you give us in real terms how many jobs actually created? I saw some numbers here, and I saw someone claiming one out of six jobs in Portland area created by the Port of Portland. Can you elaborate it and substantiate of the claims?
Mr. Chair, there are a number of, there's a handful of studies that have been done that have looked at distribution and logistics sector, for example. We provided most of the infrastructure in the Portland area, at least on the public side, that facilitates transportation. Distribution and logistics jobs in the Portland area account for depending on which study you look at, between 1 and 6 and 1 and 10, regardless of whatever that percentage is, it's a high percentage. And distribution and logistics jobs are high-wage jobs. They're about 9,000 to 10,000 higher than the average for the region. Now, when you look at those studies, they're including everything from the on-dock workers, which clearly are not directly necessarily in our employment, but we facilitate their employment, out to the tertiary effects of their salaries and the salaries of others that are working in transportation, whether it's aviation, marine, or on our properties, how those dollars are cycled into the economy. An additional factor that's figured in here is the value of having the facilities themselves in Portland. If the Port of Portland just entirely went away, the marine side, for example, all of the cargo that goes through our facilities would have to go to some other port, whether it's Port of Tacoma, Port of Seattle, Port of LA, Port of Long Beach, the fact that we're there saves local shippers a great deal of money. We figure on average for each one of the individual boxes between $200 and $400 is saved per box by us having the international terminal, the Terminal 6. I would be happy to provide you and the committee with copies of the studies that we've done on both sides of that equation, the savings to local shippers by having our properties and the jobs generated both directly on dock and at the airport, and the tertiary effects as well.
Okay. I have one last question. Do you, that the port of...
Mr. Mann wanted to comment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I could add one more thing and draw your attention. You probably will be seeing, if you have not seen, Joint Center Memorial 7, which includes some specific information on total values and job creation that port industry contributes to the state of Oregon. I helped draft that resolution along with Oregon Ports Group, and that will give you some specific information. And in closing, I would like to again thank the committee for allowing us time today, and also to bring to your attention, in summary, Goal 9, how important that is to the ports, continuing to provide assistance when you can with helping us to provide adequate inventories of industrial developable land. And if I can leave you with one thought about ports, and it was mentioned by Mr. Harlan, is that ports are not an economic draw to their communities. We do, and we are self-supporting, and we have probably of all the industries the least burden on the taxpayers when it comes to the coastal ports and the river ports. So thank you again.
Okay, and I have one question, maybe it could be a suggestion, and I'd like to know the plans of the port of Portland or the ports in the future, where we are going to be in the next 10 and 20, 30 years. Are we able to capture the market share in international strong competition, or just we are going to just let it happen and move on? I think we need to have some kind of a specific plan in the future in this strong competition. How could we capture more than the share we are sharing at this time? Do you have any plan for that, or do you have any work plan in the future?
Mr. Chair, obviously we do have a number of plans both on the aviation side and on the marine side and on the property side as well. And we have a master plan that we're supposed to provide to the Federal Aviation Administration, for example, on the aviation side, where we're looking at terminal expansions, improving our runways, improving access both through the gate for cargo shippers. We are actively, literally every day, out there working with cargo shippers on the aviation side, talking with them about the value of the Portland region, the market reach that we have. We're the best truck reach of any of any port in the Pacific Northwest. We can reach more markets from where we are. On the marine side, we have a 20-year plan, which includes expansion, actually, of Terminal 6, the international container facility that I mentioned. We can take 1.5 post-Panamax ships today. Half ships don't tend to fit in very well, so we want to be able to take two of them at once. We're in the process now of purchasing one additional crane and hopefully two out at Terminal 6 as well. So we have very aggressive plans and pursuing those plans virtually every day, but I'd be happy to expand on that in the future.
Okay, so if you have such plan, could you give us some synopsis or some information
about
the plan in the future, so we know what is going on. All right, any other questions? If not, thank you very much for giving us the information, and I do appreciate for your time doing that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And we close the public hearing. We'll close the informational meeting. Now we are going to open a work session, House Bill 2199.
Mr. Chairman, the House Bill 2199 you looked at on the 14th of March, it has to do with the vertical housing. You have an amendment, the Dash 1 amendment makes technical changes. It's from the Oregon Housing Community Services Department. You had that amendment last time, so I don't know if we handed that out again or not. I have additional copies of it if anyone needs it.
So what was the amendment?
The bill makes technical changes in it's been done in consultation with the Department of Revenue, Land Conservation and Development Department, Department of Justice. It clarifies the eligibility for and the procedures for obtaining property tax exemptions. As you may recall, this was an effort to provide incentives for mixed use projects, including commercial and residential, and the reason given for moving the program from the Oregon Economic Community Development Department to the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department is the Housing and Community Services Department's expertise in housing. One of the additional items that the bill puts into the current vertical housing program is the incentives for low-income residential spaces. You also have the from the your revenue office, the revenue impact of the proposed legislation. This is on the Dash 1 amendment. And in addition, because the measure has to do with tax incentives, the Revenue Committee has expressed interest in looking at the bill, and you actually have permission from the Speaker to give this a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee if you wish to do that.
Okay.
And is there anyone else who needs a copy of the Dash 1 amendment?
All right, so we have House Bill 2199-1 amendment in our hand.
You can ask Mr. Fisher to come explain it for Mr. Walton.
Okay, and I'd like to call this time John Fletcher and John Wolverine here. Okay, and Art, could you come also?
All right, and
this is our fish. Oh, Art Fish, which art are you talking about?
Let's wait and see what these people are saying.
Okay. We have too many arts here, so that's the problem. All right. And do you have anything to add or comment, let's say, on this Dash 1, 2199? It's all ready to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Fletcher with Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. The Dash 1 amendments did not come about just recently. We've been planning these for a long time with the cooperation of the Department of Revenue and DLCD and Economic and Community Development. We were not able to have those ready with the drop deadline for the initial bill. We just missed that, and so these Dash 1s came about after that. There are a lot of little changes, technical changes, I would say, in the Dash 1s, and rather than mark those up through the entire bill, a legislative council decided to craft the amendment the way they did, and it looks like a long bill, consequently. But the changes deal primarily with adding little phrases in some parts of the bill, such as that some information would be certified and sent back to the Department of Revenue. That was our intent anyway in the rules, but they wanted that in the statute to be sure that that process took place on the certification. That occurred a number of times throughout the bill. It made for a lot of technical changes. It looks like there's a lot here, but I think what we covered in our initial hearing as we discussed the bill is essentially the way things are with the dash ones, there's nothing that we left out of the discussion that we would need to cover in the dash one amendments.
Okay.
So I think we've covered the changes in the dash ones, and we've talked about the bill as if the dash ones were part of the bill.
All right. Thank you. Anything? No? Okay. It's well covered.
Chair Lynn, members of the committee, Arthur Fish, Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Have nothing to add. Mike Salzgiver gave you our agency's position, which is that we feel this program, which is a good program, would have a much better home with the community housing and, or a housing community services department. As far as the bill, I'm not an expert on what the bill says, but I would comment that I've worked with the Department of Revenue, and I know a lot of the issues that they have, and they're small things, but it's kind of the way that, you know, they have to, that they and the county assessors have to administer taxes. And if this were a program that, you know, we really were in a position to promote and really pay attention to as it deserves, you know, we might have come forward and asked for some of these very same technical amendments to the law itself, but since this is happening with housing community services, I'm pleased that they've had the opportunity to really get these details ironed out with the Department of Revenue and other entities. Thank you.
So do you believe this will work? Because in the past, there has been no activity at all, but I want to make sure this, with this technical change, what you mentioned, it is going to the spur the activity of the vertical housing project.
Mr. Chair, we feel that these are positive changes and that they will lead to some better opportunities for projects to be considered. It remains to be seen just how effective this will be. I think that it would be appropriate to continually watch how effective this becomes over future years, but we're confident these are positive changes.
We are going to look at this issue when we come back next session, how it's going to progress. Vice Chair Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up to your question, will there be a change in the way this program is marketed from how it was marketed under the OECDD, which I think would be a gauge of effectiveness?
Chair Lynn, Representative Bruin, the intent is to, by the way, John Wargan with Oregon Housing, the intent is to incorporate this into our structure within Oregon Housing so it becomes part of the opportunities that we talk about with each one of the projects we finance or fund. And I think as we deal with each owner in the community, as we look at a number of these opportunities each year, it's an opportunity to talk with not only development prospects but also with communities. And so we would make that a part of our regular program.
Thank you.
And we're open to suggestions regarding any marketing ideas as well.
Okay. Vice Chair Mokley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In one sentence, what do you consider to be the mission of the vertical project tax deduction?
Chair Lim and Representative Merkley, there are a few different objectives. The primary objective would be to provide a tool for communities that they might, in certain situations, allow or incent vertical housing projects, combining the residential and the commercial aspects of a project to bring more economic activity to a particular area. A secondary objective that may be part of a particular project would be the bringing in of affordable housing to those same projects, accomplishing some various objectives there for helping certain target populations be able to improve their situation and helping to integrate the community.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I'm going to follow up with a comment and just ask you to respond if you feel it's appropriate. I'd always understood this tax exemption to essentially be designed to encourage the use of the vertical space among what might otherwise be single-story buildings in the urban core, particularly the development of housing over commercial or resident or first-story commercial uses, which was a very kind of clear and targeted goal. With this amendment, I have a concern, not a concern that would lead me to vote against it, but a concern I want to express and get your response to. The first is that by redefining vertical housing to be a group of buildings, only one of which needs to have more than one stories, and in redefining the area on page 3 of the amendment to include not simply urban core, light rail, high density areas, but that a portion of only a portion of the proposed zone needs to be urban center or light rail or other places for that sort of density, that essentially what we've done is take something designed for urban core where if you have a bookstore on the first level, you want housing several stories above to change the nature of the urban core and utilize that vertical space. And now have said, well, it doesn't need to be urban core and it doesn't need to be multi-story as long as one piece of one building has an extra story added to it. And so just my concern is essentially by those two changes, there's no longer a clear sense of what this is designed to accomplish. And maybe that actually weakens the effort to have a coherent program. And that's my concern. I just thought I would put it out there for your comment.
John Wargren, Chair Lim, Representative Merkley. One of the things that we were trying to address with that was to build in more flexibility to encourage more applications, more local this all sort of starts with the local jurisdiction in many respects in terms of wanting to provide a focus. I think of the city of Milwaukee or Gresham or Beaverton in recent conversations we've had. And what we've seen is there is not a sort of a clear, there's a building box where you, in every case, have flat ground with commercial on the first floor and four stories of residential above that. What we see is, in the case of Milwaukee, a number of buildings, a key building that we're looking at for affordable housing that has some retail on the first floor, residential on all of four floors, surrounded by a number of buildings that maybe are two and three stories that are part of a project within an established zone. In the case of some of the other, so what we're trying to do is not, is to try to deal with this in rural, to be flexible, to encourage and facilitate what local jurisdictions want to achieve in their community, and build in an incentive for affordable housing. So it's not to take away from the idea that there's going to be vertical housing built. But to be more inclusive in terms of what that jurisdiction wants to achieve as a central focus.
Thank you.
Chairman and Representative Merkley, I'd like to just add, too, that we have broadened the program a little bit to be more flexible. And initially, as other agencies reviewed that broadening, there were questions similar to what you have asked. DLCD, I remember in particular, had some concerns because the language is a little broader. They were worried that this might apply to all kinds of projects, and they came up with particular extreme scenarios that, you know, could possibly qualify under this language. And they were not necessarily in favor of just doing anything under the guise of vertical housing projects. We've talked with them, and they have supported this bill because they have no objection to the bill going forward as it stands, in part because they're going to be part of the work group that helps define the administrative rules. The statute does require us to establish criteria that will be more specific. We didn't try to outline every particular combination of building in the statute, but we do want to have good guidelines that can help meet the goals that cities have, meet the land use planning objectives that DLCD has, make it workable for the county assessors, and also meet the needs of developers. So there's multiple objectives, and we hope to be able to define that a little more clearly in our administrative rules. But there are those that have those same concerns you have raised, that we can't go too far in broadening, yet we do want to broaden some to make the program more effective. As Representative Loomis indicated, we want to see what we can do to make this more effective. So there's a balance we're going to have to reach through our administrative rule process.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Fletcher, just on the issue of flexibility, was there discussion given to the 10-year length of the tax exemption with the possibility of giving the cities the flexibility to offer up to 10 years as part of the negotiations with the developer, or was the decision simply that 10 years would be the incentive that was necessary?
Representative Loom and Representative Buckley, in our discussions, we have maintained the current length of the exemption as it is in current rule and have not really entertained changes to that effect. That might be something to look at as we go forward, but I think we have kind of just maintained what we started out with in that regard. One thing along those lines we have done on a project that has been built that has maybe certain floors that qualify for this exemption, under the new proposed rules and the new proposed amendments that we have, it's possible that a project could do more in the future and rehabilitate their project and provide more residential or bring about more economic activity through certain things that they do through rehabilitation and thereby extend the exemption that they might qualify for. This is something that we considered. How would that work? How much rehabilitation would qualify? And that's something we are trying to address so that there is a possibility that additional work, additional projects could carry forward on a project that's begun. And I think that goes beyond where we are today with the current statute in some cases. But the length of time itself still remains 10 years.
John Morgan, I might add onto that. On the other side of the equation, there's the concept of monitoring, especially the affordable housing portion, which we're in the business of doing, and a certification on perhaps an annual basis that would make sure that that project is maintaining its obligations.
Just a follow-up comment.
A follow-up?
I was just wondering if the League of Oregon cities would have any desire, if the cities or counties have any desire to have the flexibility of offering up to 10 years, because not every situation is the same throughout the state.
We can certainly
pursue that. We could talk to them about that.
Thank you.
Representative Dallum.
I want to make a preface remark and then ask you some questions. In the Dalles, we had the Commodore, which did not qualify under the previous rules. And we took a building that I think is five stories and turned it from pigeon droppings and boarded windows into a beautiful facility. This legislation would make buildings neighboring that eligible. And that is correct, isn't it? We have some three-story buildings, some two-story buildings in the adjacent blocks.
John Warden, Representative Dahlem, it certainly opens up the opportunity to a greater extent for rehabilitation, in my view, of existing buildings. That the key question or the issue at which you need to define a project currently is prior to certificate of occupancy being achieved on a proposed project. My understanding is that you need to actually define and get that project certified prior to that point. So if there are neighboring buildings that are anticipating substantial rehabilitation, and for us with the federal guidelines, that usually means at least 15% of the cost of that project being implemented, then in my view, the concept would be that, yes, those neighboring buildings might qualify for vertical housing.
Certainly no guarantees, but it does give. And then the second question is, this really moves with the qualifying remarks, this project out of high-density urban areas into what I consider a rural area, the Dalles. And there would be buildings in the Dalles that would be eligible. So we really broaden the scope to make it a statewide program rather than an urban program.
Yes, Representative Ring, Representative Dahlin, I might add that we have thought about that, and when we talked about flexibility, we were trying to consider not only the major urban areas, but some of the smaller communities where they have, smaller buildings that might fit this also.
I didn't mean to pry these answers up, but I want to understand that we've now moved into House District 59. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right, and I'd like to call the Schleck, and could you give us from the county perspective, if you could? You have the last word on this, dear.
Thank you, Chair Lim and members of the committee. My name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And we did have the opportunity to review the Dash 1 amendments with the Housing Authority, with Mr. Fletcher here last Friday. From a land use perspective, we are not concerned with the proposal as long as cities and counties continue to maintain their ability to establish the vertical housing district. That is the geographic area in which you have the opportunities to avail yourself to this legislation at this point. And that is a concern from a land use standpoint, and as I'm sure you can appreciate, it's also a concern from a taxation standpoint. Because these benefits or incentives do affect property taxes, which is the lifeblood of cities and counties at this point. We are in the process of reviewing the proposals with the county assessors. They have not signed off on it as of yet. I know that housing has talked with the Department of Revenue, but sometimes county assessors look at issues a little bit differently than the Department of Revenue does for the state. So we would encourage the referral to House Revenue so this matters, so that we can continue to take a look at that.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with such a intention, and I talked to the Speaker's office, and we are going to refer this bill to the Revenue Committee, and since this is going to have a revenue impact, the state and the county also. So do we have we can do two ways. One, we can send to the Revenue Committee with recommendation, or we can send it to the Revenue Committee without recommendation. And do we have any motion?
Mr. Chair?
You want to make an amendment first.
Huh? Yeah. First thing I'd like to move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2199 for further consideration. For our consideration of 2199.
Okay, and Vice Chair Broom and move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment. Any objection? And the Dash 1 amendment is adopted. All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Broom.
Thank you. I move House Bill 2199 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and that the measure be referred to the Committee on Revenue.
Yeah, could you say that again?
Yeah. I move that we move House Bill 2199 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and that the measure be referred to the Committee on Revenue.
All right. And the Vice Chair moved House Bill 2199-1 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended, and then the measure be referred to the Committee on Revenue.
Any discussions?
Representative
Dellum. Just have one question, and for the cities and counties, that will give you opportunity for assessors to respond to this, and there's plenty of time for that.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
All right. Yes, Vice Chair Mokley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification of the motion. As stated, are you moving it to the floor, and subsequent to a floor vote, it would be referred to revenue?
No, I think the assumption here is to go to revenue and then to the floor. And if I misspoke that, I apologize. That's not my intent. My intent is revenue.
The motion is ascending to the
revenue. Pass recommendation.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
For the recommendation. Thank you. All right. Any other discussion? If not, let's call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Dallas.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Milton.
Excused.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Chair
Lynn. Aye. This motion passed and moved to the Revenue Committee. All right. Thank you very much for holding out. And I understand Vice Chair Merkley has a meeting in the governor's office, so he is excused. And then we are going to look at the... What's the other one?
We have to close this work session.
Okay. I'd like to close our work session, House Bill 2199-1, and I'm going to open a work session, House Bill 2176.
Chairman, House Bill 2176 authorizes Oregon Community Economic Community Development Department to use Brownfields redevelopment funds to pay for administrative costs of environmental actions. It also, as you will recall, eliminates the position of Brownfield redevelopment coordinator. You heard this. I don't think you've heard this previously. So this is a. No, you heard this before.
We
right?
heard once before.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
It was some time ago. Yes.
Yeah.
You have the Dash One amendment, which comes from the community, from the Economic and Community Development Department. It establishes a revolving fund for the Oregon Coalition Brownfields Cleanup Fund Program. Federal monies in the state treasury. It authorizes the department to adopt rules necessary to implement the program, and as an emergency clause would become effective upon passage.
Okay, where's the Dash One amendment?
And do you not have copies of it in your packet? Let me just. It should be in your packet.
Oh, in the packet? Oh, okay.
These packet.
Table packet.
So, and could you explain what the Dash One amendment does compared to the original one?
It is a pretty simple amendment that establishes a revolving fund in the Oregon Coalition Brownfield Cleanup Fund Program. This is federal money that comes in, and it authorizes the department to adopt rules necessary to implement the program and adds an emergency clause that would become effective upon passage. And
Karen, formal lab. Could you come and explain to us? Thank you for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you and good morning. Karen Homerack with Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Okay. I'm the Brownfields Program Manager, and what this Dash 1 does is add two sections to the House Bill 2176, essentially providing us with the authority to establish the fund at the State Treasurer's Department and also to provide us with the authority to write rules.
All right. Any questions do we have? Representative Riley?
Yeah. is there a revenue impact to creating this fund? Where does the money come from for that fund?
Chair Lim, Representative Riley, there is no fiscal impact on this bill, this request. The money is a $1.5 million grant that was awarded to the state of Oregon, to the Oregon Department of Economic and Community Development, on behalf of two other coalition partners.
Okay. Please, thank you.
Well,
okay.
It's federal money.
Okay. Right. Any other questions? If not, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
And do we have a motion to move this House Bill 2176-1?
You want to move the amendment?
But pardon?
Yeah. Yes.
What did you say?
Yes, you want to move the amendment. Correct.
Yes. And
Mr. Chair?
Vice Chair Bruin.
Yeah, first of all, I move that we attach the dash one amendment to 2176 for further consideration.
Okay, and Vice Chair moved to the 2176 for further consideration. Any objection? If not, the dash one amendment adopted. And we have a motion to move to the floor. Yes,
Mr.
Vice Chair Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we move House Bill 2176 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair moves House Bill 2176-1 move to the floor with amendment with a due pass recommendations. Any discussions? And if not, call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative
Dallas. Aye. Representative Berkeley. Excuse.
Representative
Nelson. Excuse.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Chairman.
Aye. The House Bill 2176-1 passed with a two pass recommendations to the floor. And do we do this as a consent, or do we have a carrier? What do you think?
So that's all up to you.
Okay. I think this is important enough. Someone might ask a question. Right. Yes, so. And Representative Dallam, would you like to carry this bill?
Yes, I would.
All right. Thank you. Representative Dallam will be the carrier of this bill. With that, I'm going to close a work session on House Bill 2176. And then if there's no more business.
You want to do the...
Oh, okay.
One more item of business.
Okay, one more item of business. Consideration for the adoption of a bill, of a draft.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, legislative draft 3440, members, each of the members has a copy of this. This came, you remember the day that you had your last meeting to adopt legislative drafts was also the last day for legislative council to complete those drafts, and this came out a couple of hours after you adjourned the meeting. You have permission of the speaker to go ahead and introduce this if you wish,
okay,
as a committee bill.
All right. Any objection to adopt? What was the draft number?
It's a legislative draft 3440.
Okay.
The subject matter is biomedical research facility funding.
Okay. Any objection to adopt this draft as a House? Oh, do we have a motion for that?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move that we move LC 3440 forward as a committee bill.
Okay, Vice Chair moves the LC 3440 as a committee bill. And do we need a roll call?
No, you can just ask for objections.
Okay, Steve. Any objections? If not, it's adopted. And meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.